For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
General Revelation, if you weren't here last week, that refers to revelation that God gives out that is not specific. It's not like the Bible would be considered special revelation because that's an actually defined message in words. General revelation is revelation that you can get, insight you can get about God just from looking out your window or even looking into your own heart. Things that are basically ways in which God has revealed himself to people, including people who never saw the Bible before. And we saw last week that one aspect of that was where he says that that which is known about God is clearly understood through what has been made. And so we saw that the design and the intricacy of nature powerfully suggests that somebody put this in motion and set up a system here in a designed way, and that only a certain type of being would be capable of that. It would have to be an infinite personal God. Tonight we want to focus back on this verse in Romans 1:19, where he also says something slightly different. That which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. So it's not only through what has been made out there, we can look at that and realize there must be a creator God, but also in here, there's something that we can see, something within us that potently suggests God must be real. This evidence that we're going to see. Tonight we're going to focus on one aspect of that, which is the evidence from internal consistency, or what has been called the presuppositional argument for the existence and nature of God. Okay, presupposition, that's a big word. Hate to throw big words out, but it's not that bad when you break it down. Presupposition is what you presuppose, what you suppose to be true before you even start thinking. Your assumptions about things, and people start with certain, you start with certain assumptions, and then you start to think from there. And a lot of times our assumptions may not line up with what we say we believe, or the way that we live may suggest that what we claim are our presuppositions, our assumptions, are in fact not really our true assumptions, that we're in fact behaving in a way that is confused or dishonest. A lot of times people act in ways that completely contradict their own claimed beliefs. And I think that probably if you've been around very long, you start to realize that that little saying, actions speak louder than words, is pretty wise. That's pretty true, as a matter of fact. And so, if you really believe something, your actions should be flowing out of that and demonstrating that. But when your actions contradict your claimed beliefs, or when your statements that such and such is true contradict what you earlier said you believed, then what? You must be confused or possibly even dishonest, that you're claiming to believe one thing, but in fact you really don't believe that. You believe something different. Let's take some examples. You got a friend, he says he doesn't believe in gravity and it has no effect on him. Okay? Then you go flying with him in a private plane and you notice he's wearing a parachute. You're like, so, dude, I thought you said you didn't believe in gravity and it doesn't have any effect on you. And he's like, yeah, that's right. And you say, so what's this parachute for then? You should be able to jump out of the plane without a parachute and be fine. And he's like, yeah, I just wear this. It raises questions. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? Your wife says she loves you, but she wants to have a sex affair with another man. You're just like, okay, just hold it right there. All right, you either don't know what love is, or you're being dishonest, but that's something most of us would not accept. Your friend says that he's concerned about the environment, very into the green movement, but then you watch him in his backyard pouring his car's oil into the stream that runs behind his yard. Could he really be that stupid that he doesn't know that disposing of the oil in that way is bad for the environment? Is he that confused? Or is it that this whole thing about that he's environmental and stuff is just BS, and that in fact he doesn't believe in any of that, couldn't care less? Something's wrong, right, when you see that kind of contradiction there. Now, our proposition has to do with this very area. And I'm going to teach it tonight using an illustration from a book I wrote years back. This is not my illustration. I actually got this from a philosopher, John Hick. But I've tried to simplify it to make it understandable to the public. This really totally blew my mind when I read this for the first time. The argument that we're putting forward tonight, this is the amazing claim here, is that the ability to be consistent with your assumptions, with your presuppositions, is only possible under one single worldview, and that is the Christian worldview. That Christianity is the only approach to life that gives you the ability to be consistent between what you say you believe and what your actions and everything else show that you do believe. Now let me show you why this is true. How do presuppositions interact with the evidence? Let's take this picture here. Okay, in this story, these two guys are riding in a train, sitting in a diner car there, and the train pulls into a stop at a station. They look out of their window and they see this, a hillside. And on the hillside are some white rocks, which on the grassy background have been, you know, basically are in this shape of the Canadian Railways welcomes you to Canada. So the one dude says to the other, man, I can't believe they like got people to walk up there and like carry these rocks around and set them up like this to, you know, just for that. It'd be a lot of work. The other guy sitting there says, well, I don't know about that. It is a slope, as you can see, and there are other rocks on the hillside. I'm sure from time to time, erosion and whatnot, the rocks roll down. And so it's entirely possible that these rocks have actually just sort of rolled into this particular shape purely from chance. But this is nothing but a coincidence. Okay. I don't think that would be a very convincing argument, do you? And at this point, we're talking about the same thing we were last week, the argument from design, right? It looks to me like that's a designed thing there, because especially when it correlates, just happens to correlate with certain words and letters that, it's like, I don't think so. I would be very resistant to any theory that happened by accident. It shows the marks of design all over it. Now, on the other hand, you'd have to say, technically, yes, there are other rocks. Yeah, they probably do roll down. Theoretically, it's possible, in theory at least, that could have happened by accident, but I don't think so, and I'm going to stick with my view. But you could possibly, bring that argument forward. Okay? But now we come to the part about presuppositions. Because a few minutes later, the one dude, the skeptic, the one who thinks it just happened by accident, says, so dude, we should go out and change our money over to Canadian. And the first guy's like, really? Why do you think we should do that? And he's like, can't you read? You know, we're at the border. We've got to go out and get our money changed over. All right. Now, let's hold it right there. Okay, you can claim that this happened by accident. That's one thing. That's not very likely. But then to turn around and say that it means something, that there's a message there that has some relationship to reality, you cannot say that at the same time that you say the other thing. If you think this means that we're supposed to change our money, then obviously you do not believe that it happened by accident, do you? You believe that it was placed there and it marks the border to Canada. You can't have it both ways. Your presuppositions aren't matching up with your subsequent statements of fact and belief. Well, this happens in numerous areas. Okay, this happens all the time. And anybody who's, you wouldn't have to be too smart to realize that's a flat contradiction. Let's think about some other areas then. Let's take this into other areas of life and see how the same thing happens when you try to think about the world minus the infinite personal God of the Bible. What happens? Let's think about the area of morality. Okay? Who's got a sheet of paper for me? Little object lesson here, a little piece of paper. Let's say this paper was sitting on the chair, and then a breath of wind comes along, and it falls to the ground. Now, is that event then, is that a event morally good or morally evil that just happened there? I think we have kind of the same response, right? That can't be a moral event. I mean, it's nothing. It's just matter, paper, matter, reacting to wind and physical law, gravity. You know, it's just matter reacting to physical law. There's nothing moral about that. It's just something that happened, right? Matter reacting to physical law is not a moral event. Now, if the paper falling is not a moral event because it's just matter reacting to physical law, nothing else that fits the same description would be moral either. If it's just matter being affected by a natural law, it's not a moral issue. There cannot be morality extrapolated from a model like that. But a lot of people view the entire world and everyone in it as nothing but matter. The naturalist, the atheist thinker, is basically saying the whole world is just matter reacting to physical law. And that includes the people and the other creatures and the, you know, nature and everything else in it. It's all just matter. They deny the spiritual, the supernatural side of life. So if it's all matter reacting to physical law, how can there be such a thing as morally right, good, or morally evil? It's not possible. In fact, this would be, if you saw somebody who said, I don't believe that God exists, I don't believe in the supernatural, but I think that's really morally wrong, what these people are doing. They're flatly contradicting what they say they believe by implication, aren't they? You know, I've often wondered, when I used to speculate about this, I was atheistic myself, and I could see, even as an atheist, that morality was out. You could not be an atheist and still hold to the idea of moral norms. And it was interesting to me that some fellow atheists didn't seem to see that point. I was always baffled why they wouldn't see the obvious here. We're materialists. We believe that everything is matter. So what difference does it make what happens? Matter, you know, a star blows up into a supernova, another one collapses into itself, whatever. It's all just matter reacting to physical law. We're a part of that chain. So whatever we do or don't do, nothing ultimately matters, and there is no moral right or wrong. We might suppose that, you know, a lot of atheists are very sharp, very brilliant people. And so you might wonder, well, I wonder how they would answer this question. I brought along an example. Interestingly, the defenses that I've seen from atheist thinkers on this point are amazingly weak. This is a debate between J.P. Moreland and Kai Nielsen. Kai Nielsen is a professor and head of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Calgary. He's an atheist. The author of 16 books on it, including Morality Without God. So I think this would be, in most people's opinion, an expert on this subject, wouldn't he? J.P. Moreland was a Bible-believing Christian, so they had this debate, and it's written up in this book called Does God Exist? The Great Debate. Nielsen says, there can be purpose in life, even if there is no purpose to life. Really? Okay. Yeah? Here's what he means. He says, if you have some life plan, if you want to be a doctor or a professor or a political radical, whatever you want to be, if there's something you want to do in this world, you can do that, God or no God. Well, no argument there. But is that moral language? Does that mean that that makes that morally right or wrong? What is the determining factor in what has value according to this value system? It's basically what you want to do, right? His own words. If you have something you want to do and you can do that, that makes it your purpose in life. That's your value. That's your moral good. So really, though, when you think about it, under that definition, pretty much anything goes as long as you want to do it. Did Hitler want to do what he did? Yeah, he sure did. And so he did it. So what? That makes it morally good? In fact, this to say that the fact that you want to do something makes it a value is the same as having no moral system whatsoever. He goes on, he says, you say, aren't these just your personal preferences? What foundations have you? Yeah, what basis do you have for saying this is morality, this is how I can have morality without God? Good, okay. Okay, so we're going to get the real goods here. Here it is. My conclusions rest on my considered judgments. You start with considered judgments, and then you try to get them into a coherent pattern with everything else, with the best theories of the function of morality in society, and with the best theories we have about human nature, and so forth. And that was his explanation. And I'm quoting it faithfully here now. You're invited to read the book yourself to get the full... I don't have time to read the whole chapter, but this is what he said. When Moreland challenged him, what basis do you have for moral judgment? And he says, I said that right there. Moreland took him apart. Moreland said, under Nielsen's system, the difference between, say, Mother Teresa and Hitler is roughly the same as the difference between whether I want to play a trumpet or be a baseball player. And he's clearly right, because the only, you know, it's like pseudo-morality. There is no real morality here. It's just what you want to do and what your considered judgment says that is right for you to do. I don't know whether you can see this or not, but to claim that you now have morals, even though you don't have a God, Nielsen has failed to carry that point. We, on the other hand, who believe in a personal, infinite creator, we believe in morality. And we do have a basis, and the basis is that the world was created by a being who himself is a moral being. He has a clear standard of good and evil, and he has built that into the fabric of humanity. And that's why everybody knows within themselves that certain things are wrong. You know, we'll hear people cry out against racism, against slaughter, you know, atrocities that people have done in history. And there's a moral indignation there. There's a clear knowledge that such things should not happen. A person sexually abusing some little kid, and there's that inner outrage, there's that certain knowledge that this is wrong. Not just that I prefer not to do it, but that it is wrong and should not be done by anyone. And we have a basis for believing that as Christian believers because we were created by a God who is himself moral. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that we always live morally. That's not our assumption, right? Our assumption is that moral right and wrong exists. Of course, if you follow the biblical argument, we are, you know, pretty messed up, and we're engaging in evil a lot of the time. The difference between a Christian and a non-Christian is not that Christians don't commit moral wrong and non-Christians do. Both groups commit moral wrongdoing. The difference is that the Christians are forgiven for that because they have trusted this work, that this good news that Jesus has died to forgive our sins. So there's really nothing hypocritical or inconsistent between a Christian arguing that right and wrong exist objectively, and at the same time going ahead and doing something that's wrong. He goes and tells a lie, does something that's morally wrong. I mean, there's an inconsistency in the sense that you shouldn't have done that, but not in the sense that you're fundamentally contradicting the validity of what you said earlier. It doesn't contradict it. Just because I do wrong doesn't contradict it. You know, interestingly, we go even into other religious worldviews and we find that the same problem obtains. It's not just atheists that can't explain a basis for good and evil. Pantheism, the belief that God is in all things, the belief that all of nature and the world and all of us are part of God, also have just as big a problem describing why anything would be wrong or anything would be right. Under pantheism, God is just as much a part of Hitler as he is of Mother Teresa. They're both just dimensions of God. And this is why some of the Zen masters have stated straight up that notions of goodness and evil are the sickness of the mind. That these are false dichotomies, that in fact God is, you know, the yin and the yang is all part of the unity, the whole. In Eastern religion, there is no clear basis for saying what is evil or what is good, because God is a part of all. He's just as much a part of the cancer that's eating your body as he is of the rest of your body. Animists have the same problem with morality. And we talked about the three main religious spiritual worldviews: animism, pantheism, and theism. Pantheism's got a huge problem with evil and good. Animism's got a problem with it too. Animists, their gods also commit evil deeds. Their gods murder. Their gods lie. You know, their gods commit adultery. All the things that we see, you know, in human culture, you see in the gods as well. Many of the gods are explicitly totally into evil in polytheism and animism. So what's the basis then? There is no basis. What we find in these religions is taboos, which is a different concept from morality. Most taboo thinking has to do with real creepy little things, you know, like you shouldn't drink milk on Tuesdays. They have no clear moral content, but these are things that could offend or bring down the anger of one of these nature spirits. There is no objective morality in this system. There's no basis for it. And so whether we're atheists, pantheists, or animists, we find that we must contradict our own bait. We have to go against what our presuppositions are if we come forward with any moral judgments whatsoever. And yet the funny thing is, everyone does. Everyone you talk to an atheist, you talk to a naturalist, and you will hear them putting forward moral positions on things. Certain things that shouldn't happen, that are wrong. Even though, if you analyze the basis of the thinking, there's no basis for saying that. Okay, now we may say, all right, so what? Maybe people aren't consistent. Who cares? Okay, I think it is a little bigger deal than that. Okay, here's why. What are we really talking about here? We're talking about, you know, this could also be called hypocrisy. Isn't hypocrisy when you say you believe one thing, but your life shows you believe something different? It's exactly what this is. And hypocrisy is really a form of dishonesty. And this is what the real problem here is that somebody with no basis for moral judgment, still goes forward and makes moral judgments, is either being dishonest about what they truly believe, and they're definitely being hypocritical and not following and being consistent with what they claim their belief system is. And that's a big problem. Now, here's another way to look at it. It's one thing if a person chooses to be hypocritical, and we could maybe be critical of that and say that's uncool, but it's a completely different thing if the person doesn't choose to be hypocritical, but if they have to be, they are compelled to be hypocritical. That's suggesting something else. That's suggesting, you know, okay, let me go back here. Let's say, okay, let's take another illustration. You say, I'm gonna invent a new flying aircraft. It's going to have like 5 floors on it, you know, this aircraft, and it's like round like a ball. You know, you've got the jet engines coming out, but it's just round. It just flies like that. And you're like, hey, okay, balls don't fly. If you're going to have a flying craft of some kind, it's got to have wings, you know, that are curved this way and so forth to give you lift, because that's what causes flight, right? I mean, you can't make an airplane at the shape of a ball. It's not possible. The problem is that the concept of a ball-shaped airplane simply doesn't fit reality, and therefore it will never happen and cannot happen. You have to conform to what is real if you want to fly. And this is really the heart, too, then, of the presuppositional argument. It's not just that people sometimes are inconsistent with their own beliefs. The point is that they have to be inconsistent. They have no choice but to be inconsistent because round objects don't fly. And certain belief systems simply don't fit with reality enough to live by them. You cannot live by them. It's not that you choose not to live by it. It's that you cannot. And that suggests then there's something wrong with your belief system at that point, that what you believe simply doesn't accord to reality. Oh, you see where this is heading? So what we're really saying is that there's only certain sets of assumptions and belief bases that fit with reality enough that you could live based on those, would not be self-contradictory. You could basically be internally consistent and still follow that line of thought. Let's try something else. Okay, let's take the notion of human dignity, the importance of human beings. Now, if we noticed a mosquito on us, wouldn't hesitate to swat the mosquito, right? A lot of us would eat an onion. And yet, these are living organisms. But we kill them without hesitation all the time. And none of us really have a problem with that. But then why would we be unwilling to kill human beings as well? The same person who has no problem swatting a mosquito says, no, I don't think we should kill her. She's a person. Okay, what's the difference? They're both biological entities, right? They're both living organisms. How come it's okay to kill one and not the other? What's your basis? If we believe, again, like a naturalist, that all things are just matter, material beings, then we have no basis to say that. We say today, a lot of people will tell you, all people are equal. Really? How are they equal? She's only 5'6". I'm 6 feet. That's not equal. She's a woman. I'm a man. That's not equal. I'm stronger than she is. So we're not equal in that way either. How are we equal? In a materialistic world, in a naturalistic world, why shouldn't I just take whatever I want from her, do whatever I want to her? On what basis could we say people are equal if they're just material objects, material beings only? There is no basis. There is no basis for saying that whatsoever. And therefore, for a person who says, I'm a naturalist, I don't believe in the spiritual or the supernatural, to turn around and say, oh, all people are equal, is hypocrisy. You're contradicting your own claimed beliefs at that point. Unless there's a personal and a spiritual side to life, then these statements are really nonsense. You know, people could say, well, we shouldn't kill people because that would be bad for the survival of the species. Well, that's got a couple of problems with it, doesn't it? First of all, it begs the question, why should our species survive? Where does it say that that has to happen? You know, millions of species have gone extinct. Why should humans be the only ones to survive? In fact, wouldn't the world be maybe better off without us? Or you could just as easily say, well, if our most adapted feature as a species is our enhanced ability to think and you know, our big brains that we have and our ability to learn, shouldn't we look out and realize, you know, we could go out tomorrow and kill a billion people on Earth, the aged, the weak, anybody who has genetic deformations of any kind, and so forth, and we would have enhanced humanity's ability to survive, cut down on the population problem, give us a better gene pool to breed from, and eliminate useless mouths that aren't contributing anything and that you just take. Make perfect sense from a materialistic point of view, but there's something inside that says, no, no, you can't do that. These are people you're talking about. Yeah, we know that's true. We all know it's true. And yet, what would be the basis for that if the world is nothing but a material universe? There would be no basis. Now, on the other hand, when you come from a biblical point of view, we believe that humans have this significance explicitly because they have been created, according to the Bible, in the image of God. It says right in the first chapter of the Bible that God said, let us create humans in our image. And in His image, He created them male and female. He created them. To be created in the image of God means that He built in this spiritual, personal aspect that we sense so clearly about ourselves. We're going to have more to say about that next week. We very clearly see that we are different in this regard, that we are truly spiritual and personal beings of a very high order, a very significant order, and that should be respected, and therefore people should not be mowed down. Even if it did help the survival of this, it wouldn't matter. Even if there was some pragmatic reason, there just was no justification for messing with a creature like that, that is a spiritual being. Also, as personal spiritual beings, we're all equally significant. You know, a person might be heavily disabled. They might be 100 years old or just newly born. What difference does it make? Those are physical characteristics. What matters is the person, which is the spirit, the soul of the person in there. That's what's significant. And so all of these would be significant, just as significant, whether they are different races, rich, poor, wouldn't matter. They're all spiritual beings. And so there is a basis for maintaining the dignity, the value of human life. We, as biblical believers, realize that people are more significant, whether for good or for evil. In fact, the fact that we are such lofty creatures, created in the image of God, not only means that we're more significant and capable of wonder and beauty and creativity, it also means that we are capable of atrocity, the like of which is not found in any other species. That we are capable of being worse than any other creatures on earth. Killing for the mere fun of it. Slaughtering. Destroying everything in our path. Humans are unique. Uniquely evil. And we realize that fits the picture, frankly, still. Because lofty spiritual beings can not only do more awesome things than mere animals, but they can also do more awful things than mere animals do. It actually creates a very consistent picture from first to last. A lot of people, you know, don't realize that pantheists actually have a big problem in this area. It's not just atheists that have the problem. What is the significance of humans under pantheism? It's pretty hard to say. People admire, you know, Indian culture because they won't kill any cows, you know, and they're nice to the cows. Even if your own child was starving to death, there's no way that you would slaughter a cow and feed it to the child. And it's because, you know, that they believe they have humans and the animals on the same plane. They're all inhabited by spirits. That could be your aunt that you're slaughtering. And so they won't do it. But as Francis Schaeffer pointed out, India doesn't raise the cow. They lower the human. Yeah, think about it. What we inherently and inwardly know is true is that we are not like other animals. We are qualitatively different, not just quantitatively different. And that has to do with this whole spiritual dimension within. So again, then, what does it mean when we hear someone who says, well, I'm a naturalist, I'm an atheist, I don't believe in the supernatural, but I think all people are equal. Really? What's your basis? I don't know. Well, dude, no. You have no basis to say that. You know, even in cultures around the world today, people are not equal. You know, that's very Western. We believe it. A lot of cultures don't believe that. They feel like, you know, if you're a slave, you're hardly equal to a free person. You can kill a slave. That's your business. It's your affair. It's your property anyway. We had that going here not too long ago. And so people were not equal. It's not necessarily true. It's not something that people will believe unless they have a basis to believe it. You need a basis to believe it. And the basis is that humans were created in the image of the personal, infinite God of the universe. He said, you cannot kill another human. Thou shalt not kill. So hypocrisy, self-contradiction, yeah, those things are, I think, bad. But what's really bad is when you realize that I have to contradict myself. Again, it's the same thing as before. I have no choice but to be inconsistent with my own beliefs because, why? Could it be because your beliefs are wrong? Your beliefs don't fit reality? And this is why you have to contradict them? Yeah, that's probably exactly what it is right there. Probably what it is. Let's take another area. Freedom. Freedom of choice. The freedom to be able to decide, I think I'll do this now. And that's a free choice that I make. Let's think about that under the worldview of naturalism, the no God thesis, okay? All there is just matter and energy in the universe. Let's think about that proposition. This is baking soda, and you pour some vinegar into the baking soda. And of course, we've all seen this before, you know, bubbles up. And so that's pretty predictable that would happen. Now, if you did that, you know, repeatedly, no matter how long you did it, exactly the same thing happens every single time. And we can, in fact, predict down to the smallest, finest measurement exactly how much CO2 is going to be released, exactly what's going to be left after the reaction based on how much of these reagents we put in there. The point that I'm making is this system is completely determined, okay? That the soda has no choice. The vinegar has no choice about, well, I think I'll react this time. No, I don't think I will this time. They do whatever the laws of nature, the valence of the molecules dictate how they will react and exactly how they will react, and they will do it exactly the same way every single time.
no variation.
Well, that's just the material world. Now, this is a pretty simple reaction that we're looking at here. If we had 20 reagents that we were putting together in a fairly complex reaction, it really doesn't change anything. I mean, the model is still the same, right? So what we have to see is that viewed as the uniformity of cause and effect in a closed system, that cause and effect sequence has to happen a certain way, because whatever happens here dictates what will happen there, then that and the other thing dictate what will happen here, and that just keeps happening, and we're in some sort of a chain of cause and effect events. There is no freedom in this model. And so what we learn from this is that if the universe is just matter, then the whole thing is a material machine of material cause and effect, matter reacting with matter and energy according to physical law. Now, within that conception, there is no place, there's nothing that stands outside of that cause and effect sequence. Everything is part of the cause and effect sequence, including you, including me. We are a part of that cause and effect sequence too. Unless you're going to come forward and say, oh, but we have another dimension. Oh, that we have, yes, we have a material component. Certainly that part is subject to cause and effect in natural law. But there's this other part that's like a soul, that's like a spirit. That part is free. Then you could maybe argue that we're different here. But if cause and effect explain everything there is, because all is matter and cause and effect, then that includes what you think, for instance. Your thoughts, when you think that I'm going to make a decision here, I'm going to make a choice, you tell yourself, oh, well, I'm free, I can choose whatever I want. That's an illusion. Actually, you're going, what are thoughts made up of under this model? Chemical reactions and electrical impulses. It's the combination of electrical impulses and chemical reactions in the synapse of the brain. That's what thinking is. We can measure it on a CAT scan. We can see when a brain is thinking different ways. It's all a material reaction. It's way more complicated than vinegar and soda. That's a simple reaction. This is a much more complicated reaction, but still just a chemical reaction is all it is. You get stimuli coming into the system. It's perceived by your sensory organs. It has an effect on your brain. Impulses fire. Chemicals react. And you come out with a thought. And you are completely determined to make that particular choice. Now, the smartest atheists see this pretty clearly. And if you read atheist literature, they refer to this as determinism. It's very hard to see from a purely material model how you could end up with anything other than pure determinism. We act the way we do because we have been determined to act that way, environmentally, genetically, biologically, and situationally. We are determined to act the way we do. It seems to us like we're making free choices, but that's just an illusion. Actually, we're doing whatever our culture, our setting, and our background dictates that we do. Is that true? Is that really true? Doesn't seem very true to me. I don't know. I get the feeling that I make decisions. I mean, yeah, I have tendencies. I know I don't always decide probably what I should and stuff. Sometimes I feel compelled to do certain things. I think that happens. But then there are other times where I'm certain that I could decide either thing, you know? Whether to tear the paper in half or to not, I think I could make a decision on that. I think I would be free and not determined, but I can't explain how that could be under a materialistic model. I don't know why it would not be. And so, too, that means if my thoughts are chemical reactions in response to stimuli coming in and that they're all determined, I have no way of knowing then that any of my thoughts are reliable, that my rational process has anything to do with reality, because it's all been determined. It's not freely chosen. I'm not weighing factors and making decisions and reaching conclusions at all. I'm just having chemical reactions happen that are all just as mechanical as the vinegar into the soda. I don't know whether you can see that or not, but it's right there. It's right there in front of us. Amazingly, unless we have authentic freedom, unprogrammed freedom of choice, we have no way of knowing whether our thoughts have any validity in the real world. No way to know. We might just be thinking what's dictated for us to think. J.P. Moreland points out, too, it's important to have freedom of the will in order for there to be such a thing as human moral action or moral responsibility. Well, that's true, too, isn't it? Look, free will is pretty important. I had some friends who, when they were teenagers, were pretty savage. These guys buried a cat in their yard up to the neck and then ran a lawnmower over them. A basic human atrocity. Now, those guys should be punished for that, I think. That's savage. Can't believe they did that. They thought that was cool. Someone should be punished when atrocities happen like that. And so we would, if we caught them, I'm sure that something would be done. They would be taken down and given some punishment. But what about the lawnmower? The lawnmower was involved in the crime too. Shouldn't it have to do several years in the state pen? Now, the lawnmower's just a machine, right? The lawnmower had no choice. It did whatever they made it do. We ignore the lawnmower and we follow it back to the first free-choosing moral agents. That's the guilty party, right there. Now we all say, this is obvious stuff. This is so obvious, it hurts. And so we have to have freedom of thought if we are going to argue for moral responsibility. Otherwise, people are just doing what they're determined to do. They can't help it. And how is that morally culpable then if there's no choice being made? Love, a meaningless concept, in a mechanistic material model. Think about it. In a material world, what is love? It's a chemical reaction where two people, something fires off the mating response or the herd instinct, whatever it may be, and then that creates this feeling that something matters between us. It's all just in your imagination. It's all just chemicals. It's all neurons firing. There is no such thing. Yeah. Now, every time that we protest a rapist and say that is evil, or we protest a racist and say that is wrong to be that way, we're showing that we believe that those people that do that are not determined to do it, that they weren't made to do this, but that they chose to do it. Otherwise, what is it that we're angry about? It's the fact that it's morally wrong. That's what makes you angry, and they chose to do it anyway. Our position, completely different than that. You know, we believe that human freedom is not complete. We wouldn't say that humans are completely free in their choice because we had a pretty bad episode that happened many years ago called the fall, where we fell from the state that we were supposed to be in. And God originally created humans with complete freedom of choice. But when we fell, our freedom of choice became inhibited. It became suppressed to some extent. And we find ourselves sometimes with these habits. We get tied up in things that can hold us like in a grip, you know. And this is why, for instance, if you become addicted to something, you kind of lose your freedom of choice. It's like you just feel like I have to do this. And that's real. We believe in that. And yet, though we maybe have lost some of our freedom of choice in certain areas, we believe that there's still a significant amount left. and that we still can make free choices. That addict who is helpless to say no to another fix could make the decision, and they do all the time, to go into a treatment facility where they are not going to have access to it. And so they've made a free choice at that point. And we believe that, yeah, our freedom of choice is diminished because of the fall, but it's still there. Especially, we have the freedom of choice to decide how we're going to react to God. Whether we're going to accept His gift and His good news or whether we're going to reject it. That's a choice every one of us is free enough to make. None of us are going to be able to get there in front of God when the time comes and say, well, I couldn't help it, you know. I rejected you. And people, by the way, are very mixed up on this. Especially today in postmodern culture, we tend to believe that if you're born in this country and that's the religion they have, then of course you have to be that. A claim that is false. How many of you have the same religious beliefs as your parents? A few. How many have different views? Even more. Well, it doesn't seem like we're all conditioned by how we were raised after all then, does it? A little bit of observation would show us, in fact, we think of Christianity today growing by leaps and bounds by millions of people every year in countries all over the world that have no history of Christianity and no place for Christianity in their what they call the plausibility structure of that culture. And then we look at those here in the West, which has a long history of Christianity. Christianity is declining, and other non-Western religions are on the rise here, as well as materialism. So, I mean, obviously people do make free choices, and their cultures do not dictate what they believe. This passage that we're studying in the Bible, written by Paul, teaches that. He says that people know in their hearts, that is evident within them, that an infinite personal God is there. And God made sure they know that. A lot of people haven't studied pantheism very much, even though it's very popular in our culture. And I notice, particularly on campus, a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I'm into Buddhism and so forth. They don't seem to know much about it. You know, under most pantheist doctrine, everything that happens is dictated by the laws of karma. Then in fact, the reason misfortune comes into your life, the reason you might be born, for instance, as an untouchable who may never speak to or socially interact with other people in culture, where the only thing you're qualified to do is clean out outhouses, is because of what happened in your previous life. And so as a result, it's inevitable that you would have this life of misery and rejection. And you got that coming, and frankly, there's nothing anyone can do about it. It's all determined. The concept of karma are inviolable laws of retribution. The word means in Sanskrit, retribution. And so, not only whatever happens, happens, and there's nothing you can do about it, but it would actually be sacrilegious to even try to do anything about it. There is no basis for struggling against social evil in that system. Neither is there any basis in naturalism. You have to come to theism to find a basis for saying, you know, a lot of what's going on here is wrong. Because we don't derive our sense of what's right and wrong from what our culture says, but rather from the character, the person of the infinite personal God. He is the standard that we answer to. This could actually go on in area after area. I've just picked three different areas for us to think through here. And boy, if you really want to do some in-depth reading on this and be challenged, read Cornelius Van Til would be one of the premier presuppositional apologists. There's a number of them. Fascinating to think through and start to realize, if I'm not sitting on the assumptions of theism, of the infinite personal God who created the earth, then I'm going to be forced, I'm going to be compelled to live in a way that directly denies what I say I believe. But if I live on the base of that infinite personal God, then everything suddenly becomes consistent. And I'm able to live consistently. I'm not pretending like, oh, I didn't think that. I guess I... Rather, everything starts to make sense. And why is this true? It's because certain presuppositions fit the real world in which we live. Other presuppositions do not fit that world and are in fact untrue. And this is why we can't live according to them in a consistent way. It's very powerful. It's very powerful. The more you think about this, it deserves some time and reflection, because it's not, I know this isn't real simple to understand. It's more complicated than the one we did last week. But the more you think about it, the more powerful it becomes. I'm quite taken with this. I see it all the time. And so we come back to the Word of God, and there we read that that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. So right in our makeup, right in the way we're made, I can look into myself and I realize certain things. I realize I'm not an animal. I'm not an amoeba. I'm not a mosquito. That's different than me. Yeah, I kill mosquitoes. I'm different than that. And we all know that that's true. And we can see, we can connect the dots, and we can see where this is leading. There must be some extra dimension within me, and how would I get something like that? That couldn't evolve. Hell, evolution has to do with biological entities. It has nothing to do with what? A soul? An entity that survives your physical death? There's no place for that. And that couldn't evolve. That this clearly points to, if there's something like that in there, it was put there. And whoever put it there, put that personal spiritual dimension within me, good chance that that's a personal spiritual being that did that. Not an impersonal being. An impersonal creator just wouldn't explain personhood. I'd be like water running uphill. Doesn't happen. Evident within them. So what we're saying is, when we believe that people are significant, when we believe that people are free to make decisions the way they want, at all, when we believe that people are moral beings and that there is such a thing as good and evil, then we imply by those beliefs that God must have created people with a spiritual nature. That's just implied. Any effort to deny that runs us right up onto the rocks, and we find that there's just no basis underneath. It's just hanging out, a claim hanging in midair with no basis behind. If we turn around then, and we deny though at the same time that such a God exists, if we deny that we were created by that God, then we're being either, we're very confused, we don't see the obvious implications, or we're being dishonest. And let me suggest, the second one is a pretty good guess, most of the time. I think we do see the implications. Yeah, I do. I think most of us see it real clear. That's why he says it's evident within them. We know the truth. The Bible says we all already know that God's there. We may not want to face it. In fact, we don't want to face it, and this is why we read in verse 18, the anger of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of people who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. In other words, we sense these things that I'm talking about. We sense we're definitely moral beings. We're definitely personal and spiritual beings. And not impersonal. We are personal beings, yes. And therefore, there must be a personal and spiritual creator that made us. We sense this. But a lot of us are uncomfortable with that thought. We don't want to face that. It makes us nervous. We start to realize, oh, wait a minute, who is this creator? We're scared of the idea of the creator. Or we feel like, you know, wait a minute, so if he's the creator and I'm just his creation, then he's like way up there, I'm just way down here. It's like, oh man, he may want me to like respect him, he may want me to do what he says. You know, and we have this thing called pride where I bow to no one. Okay, nobody's going to tell me what to do. And based on things like that, We suppress the truth. We would rather be internally inconsistent. We would rather take positions that deny themselves than to just face the obvious truth right in front of us, connect these dots, and draw the line out to what it points to, and accept the truth. And in all likelihood, the reason this angers God is because we're being dishonest at that point. We're choosing to manufacture a belief that we find more palatable, more to our desire, rather than the thing that we know in our heart must actually be true. That there is just one Creator God, and He's the one we need to deal with. Let's draw a couple of conclusions. Okay, first of all, we're certainly not suggesting that Christians are better than others. That's ridiculous. We don't believe that at all. We believe that we're exactly the same as everyone else. All we're saying is that God made Himself evident within us. That's all. So we need to heed that. We need to accept that fact and not suppress it. When I look within myself and I see this marvelous being that's sitting here even thinking about something as abstract as how did I get here, to even be doing that, we immediately sense, I'm different. I'm pretty lofty. I've got these amazing inner capabilities. You look and you feel the reality of love in life, and you just realize this is not just a material event. This is not a chemical reaction. There's something real here. Yeah, and we just accept that and honestly face it. Since our own actions show that at some deep level, we already know that a personal God made us, we choose then just decide, I'm not going to suppress that. I'm going to face that fact. And I'm going to ask the basic questions that immediately follow. Who is this God? What is He like? You know, we've got information on that. We can determine an answer to that question. How can you get to know that God personally? How can you be with Him forever? How can you get on His good side? How do we know that we're in there with that God? Well, that's the story of the book of Romans. This is exactly what we're going to be studying. And I suggest, in addition to continuing to read this very interesting book of Romans, that you add one more step, and that is take these questions to God in a personal way directly yourself. What harm would it do to call out and say, God, if you're there, if you hear me tonight, I want to know if you're real. I want to know who you are. I want to know how I can get in with you and be and have a relationship with you and stuff like that. What's wrong with that? What would be the harm in doing that? Because if that infinite personal God exists, He would hear you and He would answer your prayer over the next few weeks. He would come and start speaking to you in a variety of ways. Before long, if you're like me, when I said that, within a matter of weeks, I would say 3 to 6 weeks, I found myself sitting there virtually certain that God was real and that He was dealing with me in my life. When a lot of people say, well, I don't feel like doing that, you know, I don't want to do that. Why? It's not because I'm afraid if I do that and then no one answers, I'll be disappointed. I don't think so. I think it's because I'm afraid if I do that, someone will answer. I'm not sure I want that to happen. This is why. This is exactly why. Be honest with yourself. Let me make the same plea as last week. And be honest before God. Speak to Him. It ain't easy. I felt stupid as anything the first time I did this. I had never prayed in my whole life. Well, I mean, like when I was a little kid or whatever, my parents told me to. But I had never, you know, just like talking out to nothing. I felt so stupid doing that, you know. And yet I realized it's possible that He hears me right now. I actually did it in my mind. I didn't do it out loud. Same thing. You know, it's no difference. I still felt stupid. Wasn't easy. But I'm sure glad I did it. Definitely, you're going to want to keep seeing the rest of this story about the good news. This is really, these are the questions. Who this God is, what he's like, how you can come to know him. These are the big questions that this book of Romans is about. And so I'm sure you're going to want to keep reading this book if your curiosity is pricked at all. Well, I'm just going to draw the line there for tonight. Next time, one of the big objections raised to this whole view, if God is such a good God and stuff, how come the world is so messed up and evil? And what is God doing about it? What has he done? Those questions there. We're ready to jump into the rest of Romans. Lord, I guess, you know, this whole discussion tonight is kind of abstract and complicated in a way, and yet it's deep when we start to realize that inside of our own selves, we do sense that we're personal beings, and we can't account for that unless it was put there by you. You must be there. You must be personal. And of course, a lot of other questions come up at that point. We thank you that we have, that you've spoken to us, and that we've got information on this. We thank you that we're not left here to guess, but that we can actually get to a point where we know who you are, what you're like, and man, does it turn out to be good news. Very relieved to discover what a God of love you are and how accepting you are. That's a great relief. So we thank you for that, God, and we pray that you will give us the fortitude and the stamina to dig into this very deep book of Romans and stick through it, God, and get this book down so that we learn it. And we pray that in Christ's name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.